This podcast is a presentation of UCTV.tv, University of California Television. Like what you learn? Help others discover UCTV podcasts by leaving a comment or rating in iTunes.
So what was your first initial reaction when you read the script and your character?
I was thrilled because I had already signed on, so I was really happy that it was good. You know, we all kind of signed on just on Mike Schur's name and reputation, and he told us the idea, which was fascinating, and I heard that Kristen Bell was involved. So I said yes in the room, that meeting, and so grateful that I did, because it's turned out to be so funny and so much fun to be looking for the giggle again, you know. And it's very bright. It's very smart.
And, I mean, for you, I mean, you've been doing drama lately, so it is kind of a return to your roots.
Yes.
Going back to Cheers, of course. What was it? Did you think, since it's a fantasy world, it gives you a little more freedom? Where you can kind of, like, in the show itself can go anywhere. There's not many boundaries.
It is. No, you're right. He's worked out, Mike and all his amazing writers, and Drew Goddard, who directed the pilot, Martian, Academy Award nominee. They have like this, they wrote this Bible of how things happen in the afterlife. And it's really well thought out. It is carte blanche in a way, but it's also very smart, very bright.
And what was the first day like working with Kristen? Your first scene, let's say, shooting it?
It was like falling off a log because we've known each other for now about 6 years. We met on a movie up in Alaska. And just hit it off, became great friends. I love Dax, her husband, and we've got to spend a weekend or two together just before this happened. And then to find out we got to go to work together every day, it was easy. So she is so good. She's effortless, you know. But basically what she is a mother who's sitting there, you know, chatting with her kids. Right up until they say action, then she puts it down and acts. And then so she's like extraordinary actor, extraordinary mother.
And what about the visuals? I mean, it's a different kind of world. So it's not like we had Cheers where you're on one set.
Right.
Now, does it help you as an actor, kind of like an expensive visuals to get into the tone of the scene?
It's turned into Alice in Wonderland. It is so surprising where this story takes you. We have a full team of special effects artists, pardon me, you know, so every episode there are new wonderful delights. So we're not just saying this takes place in the afterlife. There's visual proof that you're there, which is fun.
All right, but now let's be honest. Which cast member would not be going to the good place, the darker cast member of TV?
I think we established early on that every artist did not make it to the good place. Basically every artist.
So, okay, great.
Yeah.
Well, thanks so much, and thank you for spending time. So question now, writing this kind of story in a fantasy world, does that kind of free you up as a writer, since you don't have any boundaries, but you do have to create them?
Yeah, it frees you up in certain ways, and then also like makes your life a lot harder, because it has the potential to just spiral out into crazy town. And a lot of what Drew Goddard and I did working on the pilot after I'd written the script was trying to find the edges of, like, is this too insane? Like, is this not insane enough? Like, you want to make use of the premise and the big idea, but not so much that it just anything can happen at any moment.
All right, and then what did you see in Kristen Bell, which made you want to cast her for that scripted character?
Well, her phenomenal talent. I would start there. I've been a fan of hers for a very long time. I've actually known her since 2001, I think, and I am in awe of her as an actress and as a comedian specifically. And also, she has this ability. Her character in this show was not a great person. She wasn't evil, but she wasn't great. And when you're writing a main character that is like that, you need the actor to be able to still be likable and warm and have people root for her. And Kristen is such an inviting presence just in general, that I felt like she was the perfect person to walk that line.
So, and she can allow you maybe to push her a little further than maybe another actress could not pull off.
That's right. And we had certain flashbacks that we showed where she did things that kind of weren't great. And I was a little bit unclear of like how far to push it. And then once Kristen was cast, it was like, oh, she can do anything and you'll still like her. So that was great.
I mean, you have Parks and Rec with a very optimistic character like Leslie Knopes. Is this kind of a different slant on optimism, or?
Yes, it is. Certainly is. Yeah, that show was all about, you know, about unity and teamwork and about optimism and how optimism defeats pessimism and that sort of thing. And this is much more about, like, the sort of a little more abstract philosophical ideas of what it means to be good and a little bit more about, like, how your behavior and how your actions affect other people and stuff like that. Yeah.
And of course, working with Ted Danson must be kind of, you know, the veteran of Cheers, yes. A legendary actor. How was that process developing his character?
It's like a dream. He's my favorite actor, I think. Cheers is my favorite show. Sam Malone is my favorite character. I worship at the altar of Ted Danson. I still can't quite believe that I get to write jokes for him every week. And he is also like so smart. And when I pitched him the show, he said, I really like this. I have a few questions. Can I ask you some questions? And I said, of course you can. You're Ted Danson. And then he asked me like 12 of the most incisive and intelligent questions about his character and about the world and like questions that immediately made the show better than it would have been without him. So he's wonderful.
Now, he just said to us that since you're all artists, none of you have really any hope of going to the good place. That's would right. You confirm that?
Oh, 100%. Yeah. There's a line in the pilot where he says, Kristen's character says, who's in the bad place? He would surprise me. And he says, well, you know, Mozart, Picasso, basically every artist ever. And so, yeah, we're all dead.
Thank you so much. So for you, you've done a ton of writing, amazing shows. Yeah. And, of course, you directed Cabin in the Woods. So what was it like for you to get on the other side of the lens and kind of tell the story visually and create this kind of very unique world?
Yeah, it was really fun because this is the first thing that I've directed that I didn't do any writing on. And it was because I loved my script so much. And so I sort of knew, okay, my job is to just protect this script and put this brilliance that I see on the page on screen. Hopefully I succeeded.
Well, it's terrific. I saw the pilot. It's terrific. Okay. So what was your initial reaction when you first read the script?
I just felt like it was like nothing I've ever read. You know, it just felt different and unique. It's hilarious, and yet it's about something. I felt like right now at this time in the world, there's so much negativity, and it felt like here's somebody trying to say, what does it mean to be a better person? Let's aspire to be better. It really resonated with me. I hope it does with other people, too.
And what did you see in Kristen Bell when the first table? Let's go back to the first table. What was that like for you?
I mean, I've been a fan of Kristen since Spartan. You know, she was she came on the screen, and then Veronica Mars, obviously, and so much. And I just felt like, oh, she's one of my favorite actors out there. And when we did our table read, the hair stood up on the back of my neck when I heard her speak Mike's words for the first time, and I knew, oh, we're going to be fine.
Because Mike and I talked about the wrong actress would have ruined it. Like, you needed someone who can push the envelope.
You know? It's a tricky thing because she does a lot of unlikable things. So you need someone who's so profoundly likable that no matter what she does, you still go, oh, you scamp. And that's Kristen has that, you know.
And will you confirm right now that The Good Place is actually the secret place in Lost at the end?
I cannot confirm that, no. But you'll just have to keep watching.
Thank you so much, Drew. Thank you. Thank you. All right, so what was your initial reaction when you read the script? Your first reaction to your character and the story in itself?
Well, I actually signed on far before the script was written. Mike gave me about a 30-minute pitch of this incredibly bizarre idea that he had just started to flesh out. And the minute he started talking about it, I knew that it combined my two favorite things, which is comedy and exploring what it means to be a good person. So I signed on immediately. And then I was just as thrilled when I read the first script because it was exactly what he intended it to be.
So, and for you, since it's a fantasy world, does it make it a little easier for you because there's no boundaries? You can actually go to places you wouldn't go in a more traditional story, which you've done, you know, the Veronica Mars and others.
Yeah, it certainly makes it a lot more fun that you can ask for anything at any time in The Good Place, that you can fly if you feel like it, that, you know, there are endless things to explore because there actually are no boundaries in the afterlife. So it does, you know, the emotional stakes are real, but the physical stakes are just there for comedy.
Right. And for you, what was the experience working with Ted Danson? Because I heard he's a problem on set. He just...
Look at him. You can tell. Yeah. Look at him. I mean, Ted Danson is an American treasure. That's a fact. He and I did a movie probably 6 years ago, just fell into adoration for each other, and we've always wanted to work together since. And I'm thrilled that hopefully for the next few years of my life, I get to spend them with him during the day, because he is an absolute joy.
And obviously, you work on a TV show. A lot of times, it's just the same set, the same simple sets, generic. This is kind of endless world. Does that make it a little more fun as an actress? Like, my God, I get to see something different each time.
Yeah. The production value, you know, it makes it harder to shoot, but we have an incredibly talented team that Mike sure has been working with for years. And we get to pop around the city of LA and pretend it's different parts of the afterlife. And we shoot a lot at Huntington Gardens, which sort of shows you this, you know, beautiful scenery, which is like the generic version of bliss when you're in the afterlife. And then we'll sometimes go down to the beach and show beautiful crashing waves or a bluff. And yeah, it really, it allows us to use all the little parts of the city to show different parts of our neighborhood.
And have you asked Mike, you know, the balance, like how far do we push my character? How dark can I go?
I think that, because now we're shooting episode 12 now, and so I think that I've settled into the place where she lives. But in the beginning, I was asking him to sort of keep me on the fine line of, she's not evil, she's not malicious, she's just utterly self-centered, and she's not yet asked herself the question of, why should I be concerned with anyone else in the room? And the things that, you know, each episode is written about this different ethical or philosophical dilemma of the ripple effect of every single one of your actions. So I definitely, we've decided we want her to be comedic, because that's the heartbeat of the show, but also have those endearing moments where you want to root for her. So there has to be some sincerity to it.
Ted and Mike both said that there's zero chance any of the actors are going to The Good Place. Would you confirm that? Do you believe that?
That may be true, but I'll tell you, I'm going to try.
Thank you so much for talking with us. What was your first reaction when you read the script? What was your emotional reaction to your character, and where, you know, what you would have to dive into?
I was struck by just the many layers of not only Philip K. Dick, but the way that it was woven together, and the way that Juliana is embedded in this world that is so many things, that is a period piece, that is a what if, you know, sort of environment that is obviously not real. So there's this fantasy and this lack of boundary, almost, you know, imagination, and yet it's a period piece at the same time. So it was a beautiful marriage for me, but mainly Philip K. Dick. That was kind of the heartstring, first and foremost.
Around episode 5 or 6, you had a fight with your boyfriend. While it was a surreal world, I thought it was a real couple having a real fight, something I very rarely see on TV. How did you approach the rawness of that scene with your fellow actor?
That is a scene, I have to say, it even just gives me goosebumps thinking about filming that experience was incredible. It felt very much like theater. We were given complete freedom. There were no marks, there were no boundaries. It was just the two of us in a room, and the cameras capturing as much as they could within that. So there was a rawness, absolutely. You know, an unpredictable quality that we don't often have in television. There's a mark, there's a certain box that we have to, in some ways, even though a lot of us fight it tooth and nail, fit inside of. But that was complete freedom, and it was a really amazing experience. Rupert and I had quite the day together.
I agree. It was one of my favorite scenes, actually, from very powerful, and both of you obviously did a great job. But in the book, we don't see the two of them together, so it was especially interesting for me to see these two together and to be really getting something real and digging into all of that emotion, because this makes them human. We're actually people, and we need to see those sorts of emotions. So it was.
You're exactly right.
It was pretty special. Yeah, thank you for noticing. I appreciate it.
So let's go back a little in time. Your first initial reaction when you read the script and your characters? Fear, trepidation, oh my God, I can't wait to play this.
When I read it, funnily enough, when Frank Spotnitz, he wrote the pilot, he actually wrote it as a two-hour special. So it was just like 2 hours, and it wasn't two different episodes, if you know what I mean. So I read it all in one go in 2 hours, and then it was just nuts. And my character, Frank, you know, he goes for a huge amount in the first two episodes. And then I had never read the book before, so I kind of thought I must. So I bought the book, and I was just amazed by the imagination of the Philip K. Dick and this idea of an alternative history where the Allies lost the war and living in America, occupied America. It was nuts, and I thought it was beautifully written. And I thought my character went through a huge change and a huge arc in episode 1 and 2, and so I was just completely hooked from that moment, really.
Your initial reaction when you read the script?
Well, I loved it. I saw storyboards before I saw the script. So I saw their storyboards, and I thought they were fascinating. And they described the way they pitched it to me was this. Imagine a world where we lost the Second World War, but also imagine what would have happened to like countries like Japan. There was never a tech boom in Japan because they didn't need it. So like you get from New York to San Francisco in 2 hours via rocket ship. So the planes look different. Like it's a world where, you know, there's the 60s never happened. Like, but we're in the 60s in the show. So that kind of idea fascinated me. But also, to be honest, the idea of being on a prestige show, I mean, there's a bunch of reasons why actors take jobs. I'm on a show called Z Nation. I take because it's fun. It doesn't pay very well, but I love it. I love doing it. But I took this job. I thought it was fascinating, but also it's Ridley Scott and Philip K. Dick. If you don't do that, and it's straight up offered to you, you have to think about why, about your career.
You're an idiot.
But then we get into it, and they all seem, the first day I shot, everyone else seems grounded in their characters. I didn't realize how big this was, like, how massively expensive it was.
Yeah.
But just the scope of the production, I didn't realize how big it was. So the whole first day, I'm shitting myself, thinking I'm going to get fired. And actors do that, but I was really doing it and freaking out. And the second day, Issa Hackett, Philip K. Dick's daughter, came up to me and said how happy they were when I was cast and how happy her dad would have been. And that made me put my big boy pants on and really be like, you have a job to do here, and it's to do justice to this book and to find this guy. And I did.
Yeah, we're getting very deep now.
Well, I mean, it's a show about America being... It's not light fair.
We talked to Alexa just a moment ago. In the middle of the season, you had what I called, and she called, the most raw fight. The big... And it was... I talked to her about it. Like, it was first time on television I saw a real couple fighting, even though it was in a surreal world, but it felt raw. And how did you guys approach that scene together?
That's really, can I use this?
Please.
Oh, it's very kind of you. I really appreciate that, because we spent a lot of time on that scene, hours, I seem to remember. It was 9 o'clock at night, we did it. The thing was, it was like a play when we did it. We improvised a lot, and I think Alexa and I loved doing that scene particularly, because it seemed to build and build and build, and we tried to make it a kind of as real and instinctive. And you know, in some fights, you know, when you're fighting really with your partner, there's moments when it goes quiet for a bit and then it kicks off again. My wife will hate me for saying that, but I love her. But anyway, you know, we try to make it real, and we worked so hard on that. And the writing was great. It was a guy called Rob Williams, I think, wrote it, that episode. And I really appreciate that, because it's one of the scenes that I'm most proud of in the first season.
Let's go back in time. Your first initial reading of the script, what was your emotional reaction or to your character and the story in the whole?
I didn't want to do it. When I read the pilot, I looked him up. I thought, oh, he's not in the book. So he's a generic Nazi bad guy, because the book lacks a central cardboard villain. Every scene, he's just striding up and down corridors, and every time he talks to someone, they're hanging upside down by chain. No, I'm not interested. But then Frank Spotnick said, I think you might like to see episode 2, because episode 1 and 2 were the original 2-hour pilots. And episode 2 was started with a breakfast scene with the Smith family at home. And then there was an insurgent attack that was shot from the perspective of my character. And suddenly this conversation that I'd had with Frank Spotnick about this potentially being the story of someone who, to all intents and purposes, would be a good man in another world, a very complex, not wholly good, but a human being, and it would put him in conflict with his belief system, etc., etc. It suddenly became the opposite of what I thought, which initially was, oh, really, another bad guy now? Come on, guys. To actually, rather than play a... I'm not particularly interested in playing good guys either. I just want to play guys. You know, that for me, this character, if I was able to do with it what I wanted, and if it turned out to be what I wanted, potentially, would be the opposite of everything that's frustrating me about what I call bad guy typecasting, because it's a person. I don't care whether people call him a bad guy, good guy, whatever. If the character is full-rounded like that, I, for the first time, would be happy to continue playing this role for a long time if there was enough potential and depth for him to go to be unpredictable in that way. So I changed my mind.
And for you, the Joe Beck relationship, the kind of the mentor-son relationship, how have you seen that evolve over the season? Or you just want him to follow your path? Do you want him? How do you feel their relationship is evolving even in the second season?
Well, I think Smith is quite capable of running at least two relationships concurrently with the same person. You know, just as we are, if we can admit it. You know, like just because he feels fatherly feelings for him doesn't mean that he doesn't also use him. Just because he likes him, it doesn't mean he likes him. Just because he wants to protect him, it doesn't mean he would kill him, wouldn't kill him. I mean, you know, all of these things run concurrently, and I think that relationship as it was kind of starts to run its course after a while, and there becomes a point where the next natural thing is a little bit of rebellion. What's interesting with Smith is you never know what is a surprise to him and what he's planned, you know. So at the moment, me and Joe Blake aren't spending a lot of time together. He's been packed off. He's not particularly happy with me. I'm not going to go on further than that, but you don't know whether that's against my wishes or within my wishes, you know. But it was a very, very interesting dynamic, and you know, there's still the connection there.
What was your reaction when you first read the script for your entry into season two?
You know, fear and excitement, I guess.
I'm just going to take this with me. See you guys
probably
later.
My reaction to most scripts, fear and excitement. No, I mean, I was excited. You know, it's a challenge, and it's to not only to step into this perfectly established world, but also to play a character that's unlike anyone I've ever really played before.
So you play a German filmmaker, which I'm assuming could possibly be based on someone real, but are you allowed to say?
I mean, I feel like she's pretty... there are a lot of parallels between my character and Leni Riefenstahl. I think, you know, we're both uber wealthy, privileged, kind of independent, but we can be because of that wealth and privilege. You know, rub shoulders with a lot of high-ranking Nazis, but don't really, you know, buy into the Nazi ideals. Yeah, I mean, definite parallels. I don't know what you're talking about. We're totally different.
Is this a company script to screen?
Oh, it's our show.
That's your show. I love it because it's like, if it's not on the page, it's not on the stage. I love that.
We'll go back when you first read the pilot. What was your initial reaction to the script and your character?
I loved him because I thought he was duplicitous, you know? I thought he was a very... I mean, yeah, he's a spy, but at the same time, he's, you know, he's this young guy kind of exploring a world that, you know, he's never seen before. You know, so he's kind of... He's becoming a man in this world. And at the same time, he has to do something that's pretty damn dark. And where they could go with that was, you know, was endless, in my opinion. So, yeah.
And you get to enjoy the fact that you really have two central relationships, Juliana, of course, but also the father figure mentor. Do you guys like the idea of being able, Rufus, so you like the idea of being able to play both types of stories, kind of the romantic story and then the other father-son story, sort of?
Yeah, I think so. I don't know how romantic it was. You know, I mean, people seem to love it and think it's so romantic. I think it was more of a... You know what? You're right. It was very romantic. It was kind of a beautiful thing. They needed each other.
they were kindred spirits.
To me, it's not like physical love. There's a special, because he's willing to die for her in a lot of ways. He's risking everything, actually, putting himself in jeopardy. It's kind of a different kind of love.
Yeah, because I think he sees a lot of himself in her, you know. And I think she means, she's what he wants to be, you know, this kind of ambitious person who's standing up for something that she believes in. So I think he sees a lot of that. So yeah, the two were great, but the fact that he was lying to her all the time, it was, I don't think he really enjoyed that, you know. I think he was he struggled with that a lot. And at the same time with Smith, he's dealing with this maniacal, crazy, you know, boss who wants him to kill everything, risk his own life. I don't think he was ready for that. So like I said, he's a young man trying to find himself in this world, and he just got thrusted into it.
So, Exorcist, you're kind of tackling a sacrilegious film. So, what was the impetus? What made you want to go back to one of the darkest horror films in the history of ever?
Yeah, I'm a hardcore horror fan. Growing up, it was a very influential film in my life when I saw it for the first time. Still one of the only films that still scares me, no matter how many times I've seen it. But the idea of doing it on television initially didn't hold much appeal for me, because it is such hallowed ground, because it is such large shoes to fill. It really felt like you're never going to remake this and do it better. You're only going to do it longer. And so when they pitched it to me, my initial thing was, I'm not going to do that, and you shouldn't either. And then I went home and thought about it, and I came back and kind of pitched the Fargo approach instead, instead of remaking the movie and retelling that same story, let's tell a brand new story with brand new characters. It takes place in the same universe as the original film. It takes place 40 years later. But we're not retelling the story of Linda Blair and Regan McNeil. We're hopefully telling a brand new story for a brand new audience, with some nods in there for the fans. There's definitely some homages, but the goal was really to create something that would stand on its own.
Obviously, the original Exorcist pushed the envelopes. Even today, a lot of stuff they did in the movie could not be done today.
Sure.
How far did you want to push this show in the same direction?
We are making lives a nightmare for the TV censors at the moment. We're trying to push it as far as you can. There's definitely some limitations that come with doing a show like this on broadcast cable, and but at the end of the day, it just forces you to be a better writer. It forces you to be more creative, because you can't. You can't fall back on easy, the shock value of a six-year-old kind of spewing profanity. You have to find new ways to creep people out besides just hitting them with gore or hitting them with language. So it's really forcing our writer's room to be extremely creative and come up with new ways to unsettle people and get inside their heads.
Thank you so much, and good luck with the premiere.
Yeah.
So what was your initial reaction? You first sat down, you first read the script. What was your emotional reaction?
Well, I didn't read it. I thought it was a terrible idea. So my agent sent it, and I thought, you can't. I'm a huge horror film fan, and The Exorcist, of course, like everyone who loves horror movies, is number one. And I was like, you can't do this. This is, like, sacred. So I didn't actually look at it, because I thought it was a remake. And then when she found out, she was like, no, you really should look at it. And I read it, and I was like, oh, okay, I see what Jeremy Slater, the brilliant writer, is doing. And he's just expanded that world, and I finished it, and I was like, I want to do this really, really bad. So then it was a case of going in and convincing Fox that I was the man to do it.
Obviously, horror film relies on a lot of nonverbal dialogue. As an actor, that must be kind of fun for you, sometimes being able to say stuff with other emotions, just, you know, with dialogue.
It's great, and I think it's quite rare on a network show for there to be a lot of space to play things out, because we've got, it's like 43 minutes or something to tell that story. So, you know, as much as Rupert Wyatt, who directed the pilot, as much as he could, he left, you know, those moments of breath in there so it can sort of settle down.
And what about the production design, the set? How did that help you get into the character?
Ethan and Abby, who did the wardrobe, are just true artists. And the whole, like, Mexican sequence, the design of the room is just absolutely extraordinary. It's great to kind of have that, you know, amount of detail on set.
Well, thank you so much. Thank you. So what was your first emotional reaction when you read the script?
At first, I got, when I read the script, I was very scared. And it's touching. Like, it's emotional. I knew it was a project I wanted to be a part of.
So about the horror genre, how did it help you going into a story that has great production design, giving you the eeriness of the set? That helped you get it ground your character?
Absolutely. I would say that all of the departments we have, all of the teams, everyone really helps create the vibe and the mood, and it really allows the actors to just sort of be and sit in and get comfortable and do our thing.
So obviously, you can't give away a lot, but I'm assuming it's a little dark, the story. Did your family have any trepidation to you tackling The Exorcist, given the history of how...
Yes.
Also sacrilegious the movie is.
Yes. I went to, I grew up, my family's Catholic, and I went to a Catholic all-girls high school. So it adds some extra layers.
Well, the Catholic Guild is certainly going to help.
Yeah.
So for you, what was the experience working with Gina Davis, such a veteran actress?
I was so excited to get to work with Gina Davis. She's just that type of actress that you just sort of want to stand around and try to get as much from her as you can. I mean, I just want to be near her and learn.
Now the demons, I assume, on set were good to work with. They were good. They were good.
The demon point, yeah. They cast them really well. Yeah. They knew all their lines.
And they made sure they didn't possess you off camera, right?
Yeah. Oh, okay. They're very professional.
All right. So, what was your initial emotional reaction when you read the script?
Scared. I mean, I read it the night before my audition in bed, and I got very scared. And probably not the best idea because I was tired the next day at my audition. So I was like, I can't sleep. I kept hearing stuff. I was like, oh no.
So, well, being haunted must not be a bad thing for an audition because your character, I assume, is supposed to be haunted.
Right. It kind of fed to that, you know. But yeah.
One of the things we teach in screenwriting at our school is to make sure not everything has to be said. Allow the actor and actress to breathe a little, maybe find nonverbal ways of saying it.
Yes.
Is that something you enjoy with this? Because especially the horror genre allows you to kind of do different ways to express an emotion.
Yes. I like that a lot. I hate when, just as an actor, I hate when they put in parentheses scared or, like, it's just all, it makes me feel like I'm not dumb, guys. I can read between the lines. Like, but Jeremy Slater, our writer, is amazing. He's great and he's super collaborative and wanted to leave it open to see, you know, what you find. Because the script's great, but then on set, when you're playing it out and you're on your feet, there's things come up that you might not find. If you just did that hard, scared, you might find something more interesting when you're on set.
Now, obviously, production design must have been amazing, especially with the horror genre. How did that help you get into the mood of the scene?
Oh, yeah, that helps a ton. We had, like, a great set designer, and the sets they built were amazing, and all the hair and makeup was really cool. You know, that all helps you get in. But it's still, you know, you look around and you're like, there's a guy here. So, you know, you kind of have to do your work and just, like, focus. And the other actors help, you know, it helps too.
So we'll start with the screenwriting question. What was your first emotional reaction when you read the script and your character?
I was really captivated. The writing was excellent, and it was very scary. And I liked, you know, I mean, that's how I pick roles, is if I read it and I say, I want to do that. Oh, I want to be in that situation. So I really responded to it. Yeah, it's a great character.
One of the things about the horror genre is a lot of times things are not said with dialogue. It allows the actor to maybe say things with facial expressions or emotion. Do you like that sometimes, be able to go for a nonverbal approach?
Oh, for sure. Yeah. No, so much can be just your reaction to things. We shot a fair number of scenes in Beetlejuice where there wasn't anything to look at, but and now you see a giant sandworm. And, well, how big is it? I look up there, you know. So I've become adept at reacting to scary things.
So the production design, this helped you get into character for, of course, for Exorcist.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, there's a lot of good scary stuff.
So you both started off as actors, of course, but acting, you know, has a certain level of responsibility. You decided to switch to forming your own production company and getting through all phases, actually, from getting a movie to the screen. What was the impetus for wanting to do that?
Well, basically it started when I was working with Robert Rodriguez and Quentin Tarantino on Grindhouse, and I discovered there were things, some films that were considered Grindhouse movies, these low-budget movies, Roger Corman-like movies, and I realized that I grew up going to the outdoor movie theaters and watching that first movie come up when it was almost still light out, you know, and that was the first movie from 6 to 8, and then another movie came on. It was double feature, and the first one was always what they call, what Quentin would call in the city, they called it a grindhouse movie. We just called it like the B movie or whatever. And decided that it might be fun to try to make one. Well, after working with Robert, who was like, I kept asking him questions about directing, and I'd never really wanted to direct before, but I was asking him a lot of stuff, and he was like, just go for him, go make it. Robert's like Jim Cameron said about Robert, the brilliant thing about Robert is that he just doesn't understand that he can't do something. Just doesn't understand that, you know, and he just does it. And I don't think Jim throws around the brilliant word too often, you know. And so I decided to make this little movie. I had a chance to make it. What happens a lot with people like me is people will make me an offer, a certain amount of money for a certain amount of work, and I'll say yes to that. And then they don't really have the money. Then they'll run around and try to say, I've got Michael Biehn, I've got this, you know, what script, what, you know, and then I'll try to make the money. So 9 times out of 10 or 19 times out of 20 or 29 times out of 30, whatever, people don't have the money. So I just say yes to everybody. And, you know, if something comes through, it comes through. And I said yes to a movie called The Victim, which was kind of like a novella,
yeah.
Not really a first-time screenwriter. And I said, yeah, sure, I'll do it. Yeah, go ahead, write me a check. Yeah. So he wrote me a check, and I took it in and cashed it. And all of a sudden, I had to make a movie, you know. So I made the movie I wrote it in 2 weeks, did pre-production.
You like totally revamped the novella into
rewrote that in 2 weeks, did all the pre-production during that two-week period of time, and then shot it in 12 days. And with one camera. We were doing like 60 setups a day. And we did the movie, and it was called The Victim. And I liked it because it was for the first time in my life as an artist, as a performer, I got to make the final decisions about everything, not just my dialogue, which I've always been, you know, like on people about, you know, directors and producers. It doesn't make any sense. Why don't we do it like this instead? I mean, it's my whole career. It's like Michael Biehn, you know, between that and I was always a pain in the ass, you know, because it doesn't make any sense. It doesn't make any difference. Shoot it, you know. Just give us one for you, one for me. Yeah, sure. Yeah, yeah.
So that's one version of how you get something from here's the paper to the screen. We also have evolved now into having one of our investors and one of our producers comes up with a lot of concepts, and he's a writer himself, but he's more of a, you know, he'll write a treatment, you know, and then he wants to help find writers and find directors and all that. And so for us with him, that process is looking at his one-pagers or treatments, deciding what we can make work, what is a great idea, what's an idea we need to, you know, work with a little and change. I mean, down to the Lincoln being one of his ideas. So, and basically it's sort of a process of then like having the writers take that one pager and turn it into a script and on a very small budget, and then having a director take it. And then, there's something about working with female directors for us that has gone very well. We do have some male directors. For some reason, the female director situation in our company seems to, you know, like where it's 4% in the world, it's like 95% in our company. And I'm not really sure exactly why, but I'm really proud of that. You know, being a woman and knowing that, like, it's giving people opportunities because they are kind of sparse.
You actually directed one of your films too, The Girl. So, what was the process for you getting behind the camera?
So The Night Visitor was the first one I directed, and that was literally like, again, with Loney and the idea, and he had a script. I said, okay, well, let's take it to the Marcus Brothers. Let's have them revamp this. They did that in about 13 days. Within that time, I cast it. Just like how, I mean, I took right after Michael. Probably shouldn't have, but, you know, cast it in 13 days. Got Breanne Davis and Mark Gant got, like, blindly behind me, which I will forever be grateful for. And therefore, she's gone on to direct, you know, things with us. He's gone on to star in other things with us. But, you know, and she jumped in as the lead, and he jumped in as producer. And we shot it in, I want to say, 6 days. And we shot it in our house, and it was found footage, and it was basically just taking the leap because Loney had been turned down by so many people. He'd gone out to many people before me. And finally, I just said, you know what? I think I can do it, and I think I should direct it. And that's kind of how it happened, you know? And he went, okay. You know, it was literally like that. And then with The Girl, other people had been directing, and other things had been happening, and our company had gotten much more evolved. And you know, do you even remember how I ended up directing The Girl? I'm not even sure how I ended up there. I was actually shooting Everly in Serbia with Salma Hayek while prepping to film The Girl. So I was like director prepping shot lists and conversations and stuff from Serbia, you know. So it was kind of insane. I literally got off the plane. I think we had a day in between to like get myself together, and then we started shooting. And I'll tell you, I'm a really good producer. I really love my acting career. I'm very proud of what I've done as an actress. And I think that the movies that I've directed are enjoyable, and I'm proud of what I've done. I think there are people who are way better at it and way more passionate than me. And I'm going to leave it to them from here on out.
Now, in some ways, you did a movie a long time ago from an unknown director. I don't even think he even works today. Name's James Cameron. I'm not sure if he's still employed. Terminator. So in some way, did that in some way help you? Because that was a low budget. You had to go with a very shoestring budget for what you're trying to do. Did that kind of maybe help you, you know, give you a breath of what you could do with just a good script or, you know, the right cast when you don't have all the financial tools?
Well, you know, that was made for $6.5 million. But, you know, a lot of that money went into stands, you know, visual effects. Not that they weren't visual effects. They were, practical effects of the Terminator. And, you know, that was an 11-week shoot. And it was...
time and money they had more of.
You know, it was considered a low-budget movie at the time. The thing about the Terminator is, like, everybody always thinks, oh, the Terminator, yeah, it's big... kind of hit like movie, and it did cost 6.5 to make, and it made 40, so it was a successful movie. But that year it was not in the top 20 movies box office wise, you know. Most people saw that, I think, on their
DVD players or what was it, before laser that. Disc or
but no before that
VHS thank
VHS
you.
Yeah. So
VHS.
So I mean, you know, this has got a completely different feel to it. I mean, Jim's movies were, you know, you go in and, I mean, it was, and Jim is so smart, too. I mean, there's a great documentary on Making of Aliens, and there's a great documentary on the making of The Terminator on YouTube.
Yeah.
And they're both just show you the sheer brilliance of this guy as a filmmaker, you know. And what he had to work with and what he made work back then. And you look at stuff like the CGI that he did, which was the first CGI in The Abyss. I think the first time that CGI was ever used. And you look at that and you see CGI now and you go like, helicopter looked a little, you know, this looked a little fun. That, you know, you can go back to The Abyss and look at that CGI and it's still... holds up, so looks great, you know. And he's just a brilliant guy. He's a he's a passionate guy, and he's but so's Robert Rodriguez, and so's Quentin Tarantino, you know, and so are, you know, so is Michael Bay. I mean, these the people, they just love films, and look at Ridley Scott, and look at Clint Eastwood. I mean, they're in their 80s, and I'm not sure how old they are.
Too old to keep directing.
I don't. Yeah, but not on that budget. Not on one of ours.
So really, the question is because we have a lot of students, women, who want to go into film. What are you looking for? Because one of my fears is when they don't see students don't see women in film in the roles, they're not going to pursue it. And as we know, even if the odds are fair, it's a long, tough fight. No matter what, you know, just trying to get into the industry. What advice do you have given the young women students? Because still, I mean, Hollywood, like you said, is under 20% screenwriters, still under 10% for directors.
Right. But, you know, it's
can I answer that?
Yeah. I would rather.
Go make a movie.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay? If you can write, then write a story. Think about something that happened in your life that was interesting and go write the story. If you can't write, find somebody who can write. And write that story, and then go make the movie. And that's what Robert Rodriguez is all about. You know, is Rebel Without a Crew. You know, his book was like, just go do it. You know, don't. You know, just make it. Just go make it yourself. You know, and get it done. And if you have a good script, you'll definitely be able to find somebody who'll want to direct it. You'll definitely be able to find actors that'll want to be in it. Crew's a little bit harder to put together, but, you know, you can make a small movie with a few characters and a few locations, and if it's written well, like I said, we did one in a car, you know, just go make it. Go do it. Yeah, go do it, you know. I don't know anybody that's an actor or not working in studios and so on and so forth at the studio level, but I don't know anybody that would shy away from a woman who's passionate and cares about directing or writing or doing anything when it has to do with movies. I mean, look at this one.
Well, thank you so much.
I'm tenacious.
Our big question for you is, what came first? Were you always interested in art and drawing or acting, or did one they fed each other even as you started your career early?
Well, I grew up in a family. I'm one of six kids, and my parents were very supportive of us in everything that we wanted to do. My sister trained to be a concert pianist, so she was our alarm clock, playing Chopin, you know, playing Wagner, playing Beethoven. And when I was 10 years old in the fourth grade, she was a bit older than me, I decided I wanted to play the trumpet. So I started playing the trumpet. But I had art classes for a while, but at some point I had to make a decision. Is it music or is it art? And I could only do one. So I ended up doing music. But I always knew that I had an ability to do art. And I never let that go. But I also could do voices and make people laugh, and I did competitions, and then I found out, you know, judges would say, you have an interesting voice, you should do cartoons for a living, and I thought, wow, it never occurred to me. And then that's the path I started to take, but I've always been an artist, you know?
So then if we go back to the Tracy Ullman show, you got to be on the ground floor of the animation part and developing your character. Which is actually not normal. A lot of times you get the script or something like that, but you were in the both ground floors of it. How was that for you at the beginning?
Well, at the beginning when I heard about it, it wasn't really a show. It was those little vignettes. And I kind of actually, to be honest with you, it's kind of like it's not even a show. So it didn't quite rate in terms of like, well, I'll go audition for it, but it's, you know, it's just a little thing. Maybe I'll get another little job. And it was just a little job. And then I got hired for it. And I still thought, wow, it's just a little job. But when they decided to roll it over into its own show, then it was like, wait a minute. So wait, what are you going to do? It's going to like be on at 8 o'clock. And it's going to be like a show on network television, on a network that's not really a network. Because Fox only reached 70% of the audience. I mean, all of us, like, we all hope that a show is going to be successful, but it was so unique. There was nothing like this on primetime television. So that was my beginning. I said, wow, this is wow, and the people, wow, and it's getting a lot of attention. This is amazing, you know?
And why do you think after so many years, it's still, well, obviously the writing is still great, the voicing, the animation, but why do you think it still holds dear to people and it's, several generations now have adopted it?
Yeah, I think there's just a real truth to what it is that we're doing. You said it. It's like, it's the writing. They capture an honesty about the core of our culture, and they zero in on what seems to be important. And there's a lot of agreement on what it is that they're communicating. And they also present it, a story in a way that's, you know, it's satire, it's challenging, it's poking gentle fun without humiliating someone. And it's, we lead the way in that respect.
Well, this is actually our last interview. So is there any way Bart Simpson can sign off on our show from Comic-Con?
Yeah, man, I'm out of here, dude.
Thank you so much.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.